Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. Joining me this week is Noah Pryor, CTO of Teachable. Noah, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And if you could tell our listeners, what got you interested in technology? What kind of sparked it way back in the day?
So my parents started a very non-tech business when I was 5 or 6. They started a fair trade cowboy hat wholesaler. I guess I'll plug them, sunbody.com, and left their previous nonprofit, which involved inheriting, stealing, leaving with a lot of old sort of 386, 486 type computers, 286s. There was like one 586. That was the Pentium, the golden age. So I started messing around with those. There were just a lot in a room there for DOS and so forth. My dad is a big fan of DBase 2, which was last updated in 1985. And it's like a combination database programming language. So beat my head against that for a little bit. And then sort of ended up making GeoCities websites towards the end of elementary school. Mine was for Age of Empires and making one for my cousin for Harry Potter, which was much more popular. Still a little upset about it. I think he was just refreshing and juicing the stat counter.
Darn that Harry Potter.
It is possible that Harry Potter had a larger fan base than the medieval video game I was playing. That did not really enter my calculations at the time. But yeah, it was really the sort of first tech things I did.
And this is when you're living in Houston?
Yeah, I grew up in Houston.
Okay. Well, that would explain the cowboy hat business.
Yes, it is slightly less weird there, though honestly still pretty weird. Not that many cowboy hats in Texas anymore.
So then did you start trying to teach yourself programming?
Yeah, so then after I was sort of doing GeoCities websites and stuff, I decided I wanted to be a real programmer. So I went to a used bookstore and I bought some programming books from like 1992, 1993, and like old game developer magazines and stuff like that. And I read some editorial that said object-oriented programming was a fad and like all the real work and real programming would always be done in C. And I was like, well, I want to be a real programmer. What I really wanted to do was make things with graphics. So C was a terrible choice. But I spent about a year in middle school making Mad Libs and calculators that couldn't handle floating point and burning them to CDs and trying to sell them to people at my middle school with mixed results. Basically no success. Yeah, I think I sold a couple. Always wanted to make a video game where you could shoot the teachers. And I felt like even as an 11-year-old, that was probably a pretty bad idea.
Well, but still an entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah, I learned a lot. So yeah, I kind of backed away for a few years then until I ended up picking up WordPress and PHP in high school with a how to build a computer blog, BYOPC.
And so what were you building when you were working with WordPress in high school?
So there was the how to build a computer site. I figured out there were sites that would pay you to do like $5 blog posts at the time, or like $5 to write a blog post. And the blog posts were only 60 words, and they just had to include the backlink for SEO. I think it was like pay you to blog or some very legitimate sounding website like that, that I'm sure no longer exists. And I realized that if you bought other people's domains that were more than 90 days old, you would qualify. They didn't really care about traffic. They just cared about the age of the backlinks. And if you bought already existing domains that were more than 3 months old, that worked. So I had this whole blog network of blogs with no traffic that I wrote about like leather wallets or whatever they wanted me to on and just wrote up stream of consciousness and paid for beer in college.
So you were a blog farmer.
Yeah, I also wrote ebooks teaching other people how to do it. It was not the greatest.
Yeah,
it worked.
You do what you have to make beer money in college.
Yeah, pretty much.
So where'd you go to school?
I started college at Vanderbilt in Nashville and spent a year there. Did not really like it, but was also trying to do like the long distance high school relationship thing. So any kids listening to this, don't do that. Ended up transferring after a year to Columbia in New York, where my girlfriend ended up going. We promptly broke up, but I stayed at Columbia and finished my degree there. Though I studied economics, I've never actually taken any computer science courses, which I used to have a huge chip on my shoulder about.
As you study economics, you get towards your senior year, the IB guys must have been knocking at your door.
I mean, I wasn't a great student, so I wouldn't say they were beating down my door. But yeah, that was the path that basically 2/3 of the economic majors or so, which is the biggest major at Columbia at the time. Now it's CompSci, which is wild. So I did somewhere over 100 interviews with various banks and training firms and so forth and discovered that I did not want to be a banker. Bankers did not want me to be a banker. And the answer to why do you want to work in finance is apparently not because it seems like you guys are winning. They would appreciate the honesty. They do not.
So what did you decide to do after that?
So I'd been, I guess, obsessed with startups and tech forever. years I've been reading the Paul Graham essays and so forth, had some side projects in college, but managed to get a job. It's the first paid marketing person at SeatGeek, which is pretty big now. There were like 18 people at the time. At the time, they were all scalp tickets. I think they do direct listings now, but I was basically making ads for primarily Justin Bieber concerts all day because StubHub had the SEO, so they owned the Rolling Stones sold out shows. So it was like the new hot artists. So I did that for 3 months, spending most of my time staying up late, making Rails apps to generate the advertisements, which was not what I was supposed to be doing before they were like, yeah, I think you should find something else. But until about 2 years ago, I would regularly find just sultry pictures of 18-year-old Justin Bieber on my computer in different folders from those days. So I am glad I am past that point.
What a lucky treasure trove.
Oh, yeah. So many.
So you move on there to Brightbox, right?
Yeah. So Brightbox was my first professional programming job. I mean, I'd done sort of like made a website for my dentist to fill cavities in high school and stuff, and scammed British Columbia kids in college to be their Zuckerberg to their Winklevi twins, basically making a social network. But yeah, so Brightbox was cell phone charging kiosks. This was sort of 2012. So the idea was basically nobody knew how to manage the battery life of their phone yet. And it was pretty bad. This was like pre-Pokemon Go and kind of everybody bought external battery packs and so forth. So the idea was that it's a sort of a vending machine. It's got six chambers. You swipe your credit card, a chamber pops open. You put your phone in there. There's a cable to charge it. It locks. Your card's your key. You can come back and get it. And you don't have to stand at the creepy corner of the bar all night. So that was third-ish, something like that, programmer hired there and built sort of all of the back-end applications that the devices talk to. Hardware's a lot of fun. It's really, really hard. Not having marginal costs is pretty incredible in software. I would definitely recommend sticking with that if you can. I don't know. All of the support tickets were just wasted people at 3 a.m. who had used their card as the tab after using it to lock their phone and forgot about it.
Why can't I get my phone back?
Please don't rip it off the wall, sir. Please don't rip it off the wall. Like, we will get it back in. Don't worry.
All right. So after returning everyone's phone at the end of the night, what do you end up doing after that?
So after that, I moved to a company called iCapital Network. I went back towards fintech. I told myself it would be more of a startup and less of a finance company. That was not really true, at least in terms of culture. Right after I left, they were starting to talk about making all the engineers wear suits so that people would be impressed when they came into the office, and all the engineers in suits. But the idea there was they got backed by a lot of people and sort of had this data set on like the performance of all of the sort of alternative assets. So private equity, venture capital, and hedge funds, and would provide sort of a way for just regular super rich people to invest in those. Right now, it's mostly pension funds and things like that that get to invest in alternative assets. And if you are a connected rich person that knows the right group in New York, and they wanted to democratize that to just your regular everyday Joe with at least $10 million. So I spent quite a bit of my time making forms where you said, yes, I definitely have $10 million, which is this tier above accredited purchaser called, I believe, qualified purchaser that I had no idea existed before that job.
Oh, okay. I've heard of accredited investor, someone who has a million in assets or at least X amount of W-2 income. So a qualified purchaser has like $10 million investable or?
Yeah, I think accredited investor, in my understanding of the last couple of years, is like $2 million outside the value of your primary home or more than $200K a year for the last 2 years. Qualified purchaser is at least $10 million or like a couple million a year in revenue or something like that. So the very high net worth individual is the industry term for it. There are lots of euphemisms for being super rich in that space.
Okay, so hanging around here, not finding these folks terribly relatable?
Yeah, no, it was very hard to put myself in the shoes of a customer of just, I don't know, if you have $10 million, like, go buy an island. Do you really need to invest in distressed debt in Latin America or something that sounds kind of evil like that? I mean, it was really cool data. So it was super interesting seeing, like, the performance of everyone or, like, all of those funds and, you know, oh, Union Square Ventures is killing it and so forth. It was kind of neat because I've been following startups for a while.
So did these guys have a unique performance index? Because it sounds like they had access to like, how's a obscure hedge fund doing where you don't normally see that sort of stuff published?
Yeah. So basically in the 90s, there were like 20 alternative assets funds raising money at any given time. So it's relatively easy to keep track of sort of which ones were around. By 2012, there were like 1,800 at any given time raising money. And the way alternative assets work, the fee structure generally is they take 2 and 20. So they take 2% of the total amount invested every year to like build their office and so forth in theory, and then 20% of the profits. With 1,800 or so funds there, you didn't know how to find the ones to invest in. So there rose this class, this sort of industry called placement agents. And basically what they would do, they were usually parts of banks like Credit Suisse and stuff like that. You would call them and be like, I want to invest in something like distressed debt in Latin America or whatever. And they would be like, oh, I've got just the guy. And they introduce you to an alternative asset hedge fund or a private equity company. And then they also take 2% of the assets every year. So the top quarter of alternative asset funds, you can make the case that are one of the few things to beat index funds, even after fees for investing. But once you start taking another 2% every year, like you have to be beating the market by so much that it becomes this sort of much less attractive investment. So basically a group of those companies that had placement agents, including Credit Suisse and PitchBook was one of the data sources and so forth, realized this was not tenable long term and were like, let's back iCapital to sort of disrupt ourselves more or less.
So if they invest in something and it makes 5%, they take 20% or 1% off the top.
Yeah.
And then the other 4% goes to the guy that found it for you and 2% to the guy that invested it. So you're just treading water and losing to inflation.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I'm less convinced now about the sort of top quartile firms beating the market. That is true, but there's very little correlation between who is the top quartile firm now. And I think it actually makes you less likely to be top quartile next time. If you were top quartile now, it's still like pretty random.
Okay. So after iCapital, you're saying, you know what? I confirmed my theory that I do not love this industry. Then what next?
So that was when I joined Teachable. It was called Fedora at the time. I was basically looking for sort of Brightbox-esque back, ideally with leadership I liked, and was talking to a lot of 10 to 20-ish person companies and got a random message from, can I curse on this?
No? You can, okay. We'll bleep it.
Okay. AngelList had some sort of new jobs platform at the time, and Ankur and I had both swiped right on each other effectively and got a message from him that was something to the effect of, this Tinder bull wanna talk or something like that. And I was like, oh, well, it is near another interview I'm doing. Sure, I'll go talk to this guy. Met him in a very sad, no Windows, 500 startups co-working space, but hit it off. I had made an app for finding cheaper used textbooks in college, and he had some much more successful college, like Facebook ads ventures that we sort of bonded over and hit it off. He had started Teachable, which is at the time was basically a specialized website builder for courses. You could think of it as Shopify for courses. He had gotten an MVP out of frustrations teaching on Udemy, which is like a course marketplace, and got cold emailed the top 20 Udemy instructors and 10 of them signed up. And he was like, oh my God, this could be a real business. And I am FTPing PHP files up to the server. This is not a real code base anybody else could ever work on. So I joined, we hired a couple other engineers and just sort of started rewriting it from scratch and kind of took it from there. Now we're 200 people or something like that.
Wow. So let me rewind a sec. I am a Udemy customer.
Okay.
I've done a few courses on there, the GH5 for video and Photoshop for beginners. How does that model work? Does anyone make money teaching on there?
Yeah, people do. Basically, his frustration was he found it relatively easy to get to $100 to $500 a month in revenue, and it's really hard to get past $1,000. I mean, it's sort of classic marketplace issues where once your marketplace gets big enough, you don't have to care about the instructors or the sellers as much because you have such a big built-in audience. So at the time, they would send 90% off coupons for like related courses to your students. So rather than buying your advanced Python course, they would buy somebody else's. You can't contact your students, so you can't really recommend other courses to them. They don't really become your customers. It can kind of work as brand building, but there's not a good way to ever sell to them again in the future. So we still encourage lots of our customers host on Udemy as well. It's just they're promoting it themselves rather than promoting the Udemy version. They'll promote the one on Teachable so that they get the email and keep a much higher share of the proceeds and all that stuff. But I don't know, you know, $500 is $500. Keep it on Udemy if you're making money there.
So you're allowed to have your course on more than one platform at once?
Yeah, we do not have an exclusivity thing. I don't think Udemy does. If they do, I've never heard of them enforcing it.
I got contacted by someone that's like, hey, do you want to make a course on how to publish a podcast? And you can put it on our thing, but then it becomes our content and there's all sorts of restrictions. And I was like, this does not sound like the juice is worth the squeeze.
Yeah, no, I would stay away from that.
All right, so Ankur starts Teachable, you join, originally FTPing a bunch of stuff around, then how does the stack change over time?
Yeah, so we switch it over to sort of a Rails application using basically everything Shopify had ever written on their engineering blog. Pretty similar tech stacks and sort of similar. You want a customizable white label system. So used Liquid Markup as the templating theming language for the student side where people take courses and then did a. Unfortunately, I ignored the front-end engineer that I'd hired who was like, hey man, React looks really cool. We should do that. And instead went with AngularJS for the admin section, which would have been an obviously bad idea 6 months later, but seemed fine at the time. So we're still unwinding that and hosted it on Heroku to start. We have since sort of moved to AWS, but sort of Rails app, single page app admin, server-side rendered, student-side was sort of the original application flow. And we launched that to the first customers about 6 months after I joined in like October or so of 2014.
And so is it the same sort of instructor to retail consumer model, or is there any grouping that goes on? Or
what do you mean by that?
So this guy, Miles Feeney on Udemy, put up his GH5 course and I'm one customer and you would be another. Is there anything like a classroom where several people are getting together, or is it more individual?
It's mostly individual right now. Cohort-based courses are definitely one of the big buzzword term for it. In the industry, you get much higher completion rates and so forth if they're sort of accountability partners. And hopefully if you're the instructor, you don't have to be there and be the accountability partner for everybody. So that's great. So we've got a few courses. Tiago's Building a Second Brain is one on our system that's really successful about like those elaborate note-taking systems, getting things done and so forth. We have sort of coaching sessions and like a community forum that we've built in and so forth. But I would say there's still a lot more to do there. Most courses are pretty asynchronous, just a series of videos and PDFs and so forth.
I think the cohort stuff's a good idea. It just gives you a little peer pressure to get it done, a little extra something. Whereas if you just rely on your own motivation to get through that next module, make the time.
Yeah, there are a lot of stories creators in the industry tell yourself about how like you don't have to finish a course to get value from it. And like I've bought a lot of programming books and read like 3 chapters and it was great ROI and so forth. But it's really nice if the completion rates are not so low that you have to tell yourself all of those stories about how people are still getting value from it. And it's pretty impressive how much of a difference the cohort-based courses tend to make.
Yeah, I have a bit of a backlog on Udemy right now. I've been meaning to learn Photoshop and just been kind of kicking that can down the road.
I'm sure there'll be a new one soon.
True enough.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Syrinx? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for summer.
So I think your company was acquired, right?
Yeah, we were bought last April. We announced it the first remote day of the pandemic, which was a really fun stress test for doing a remote all hands. By a company called Hotmart, which is more or less the Brazilian version of Teachable, or maybe like a Gumroad. They're sort of more digital products in general. They're huge. They're about 3 or 4 times their size. They're big in Latin America and Brazil primarily. They have no real US presence.
And are you under their shingle? Or are you working heavily with them? Or are they kind of letting you guys continue the Teachable autonomy?
They've given us a pretty long rope, I guess. Yeah, I mean, they don't think their business model would work particularly well here. They're very much like an all-in-one platform, whereas we try to integrate with Mixpanel and all of the other SaaS applications you might be using to run your business. Here, we talk to them a lot about shared technologies. We're probably going to work on using the same video transcoding system and so forth, since that's one of our big costs, or handling a joint team working on global sales tax liability and super fun stuff like that to deal with. But they'll remain, at least for the foreseeable future, like distinct brands and platforms with their own sort of upsides and so forth.
So you mentioned transcoding. How does that work? People make it in whatever they want, a MOVE, an MP4, or whatever, and then how do you guys standardize that?
So right now we pay a company called Wistia as a vendor for it, which works pretty well for us, but the median customer for Wistia, I think, probably has 3 videos with Wistia. It's basically like their primary use case is like you want a marketing video on your company's homepage and you don't want the YouTube logo in the bottom right. So originally they didn't charge for transcoding. They just charged for bandwidth out, which was fantastic for us because we have lots of videos. Lots of them are not watched very many times. Now that we have somewhere north of 6 million videos on the platform, they have negotiated a less favorable deal for us, which is understandable. They want to stay in business. So we're looking to moving to our own Kubernetes pipeline, I think using whatever the thing that came after Elastic Transcode is that's cheaper from AWS. Media Elements, perhaps. I always lose those. What are the AWS services quizzes?
So it might become time and might be cheaper to roll your own.
Well, they've already rolled their own, so we're hoping we can just use theirs, basically. And obviously, it's never just use theirs, so we'll see sometime in October or so if this works.
Yep. So with 6 million videos, all user-generated content, you must have had some sort of takedown requests at one time or another.
Oh, yeah. We have gotten a variety. I mean, one of the more entertaining categories we get is you can hire services to look for your course being pirated on the internet elsewhere. These services are often not very good, or at least not very tailored. So about once a month, we get a very strongly worded email either from a lawyer or from AWS asking us to remove our customer's course that they uploaded to Teachable from Teachable because their lawyer has lost track. And we get to write back being like, well, this is your client's website, but sure, it's gone now. I enjoy that conversation with them. But other times, you know, we've had it basically where people have their videos stolen and people copy the embed codes and try to like upload them other places and so forth. We now have domain restrictions against this, but we didn't about a year ago. So there was an SAT prep course that was pretty popular and was just getting wholesale ripped off by another website. So like domain was satprep.com. The other person had satprep.io and it looked exactly the same, running out of Egypt or something like that. So they asked us to basically delete and re-upload all of their videos. So to break the embeds on other websites. And I was like, oh yeah, sure, I can take this one. Everyone else is busy. And this is the kind of thing I've done many times before. Thought it would be safe. Did not have a code review or anything like that. And I messed up the script. And rather than taking down their video, I made their video, every video on the platform. Missed the where on that update query.
So no matter what video you were trying to watch.
Yeah, any of the 4 million or so you saw how to do, I guess it wasn't analogies because they've dropped analogies in the SAT, but something of that nature. So immediately they'd been posting in our community forum asking for help with this. Immediately other customers started accusing them of hacking Teachable in rage. And making their video all of the other videos to avoid setting it down. So I had to like go in and be like, no, CTO just made a really dumb mistake. This is totally on us.
I'm the guy that Rickrolled you.
Yeah, it was me. I apologize, guys. When you make that level of mistake, honestly, people aren't usually too mad because it's just so ridiculous. It's really a very good relationship with that customer now. Did some firefighting together.
As long as you can roll back.
Yeah, yeah, we got it back. A couple hours of no videos on the platform, but got them back.
So in your spare time, do you do any programming projects or anything like that?
Yeah, I've done a bunch. I love web scraping because when I was starting programming, I found it really good for side projects. And the thing you run into with side projects is like, this isn't interesting unless people are using it. Like if you make a Facebook, it's super boring unless you convince other people to use it and fill it with data. I'm a programmer. I'm not great at getting people to use things necessarily. So web scraping provides a way to create a site that, you know, looks alive and has interesting things going on. So I made a site, standupin.nyc, for finding stand-up comedy shows in New York and letting you sort of follow stand-up comedians and so forth. The eventual goal idea was like it would show their most popular YouTube video or tweet or something like that. And kind of like, because you haven't heard of any of these comedians usually for like your average show and a Friday night or Thursday night. So you could go make sort of a snap decision about which of the 5 shows that night you wanted to go see. More recently, I've been working on looking for apartments, thanks to acquisition. So have been working on a like Chrome extension that layers on top of StreetEasy and Zillow and shows what the taxes are for things once the tax abatement runs out, which no one tells you. And lots of things in New York are like listed as $20 a month in taxes. But in 2023, it's going to be $4,000 a month in taxes. And that's a really good thing to know before you buy something. It's a 5-year ramp off. It's not quite that bad. But they'll list the like current temporary lower prices.
So how does that work? Because like in Massachusetts, you get your monthly rent. And if there's property taxes, that's generally the problem of the landlord. And there's usually not big jumps year to year. What happens there in New York?
So this is for buying a condo or something like that. For renting, yeah, it's handled by the landlord. So they've ended it now, but there was the 428 tax abatement program in New York, basically for building things either with affordable housing or in what they consider areas that need development. They're all in like really fancy areas now. It's right by Barclays Center or what have you. And you're like, really? This was a blighted region? Are you kidding me? This is Park Slope. Basically, it's like 95% off property taxes for the first 15 or 10 to 25 years, and then it ramps up over the last five to what the taxes would be otherwise. So New York City has surprisingly good open data. So you can hit the like property tax API and see what the last property tax bill they got was, which has the assessed value. This is how much we're abating of the assessed value. And then you can multiply that by the tax class to figure out. I mean, you don't know what the real estate value will be in 20 years or whenever the abatement ends, but you can say if there was no tax abatement today, this is what the taxes would be.
Oh, so you could buy a condo and then all of a sudden when that runs out, bang, you got a ton of taxes to deal with?
Yes. So there are lots of places now because I think the system kind of, I don't know, it ended in like 2008. We're closing in on the end of a lot of the like 15-year ones. So there's lots of places that, you know, it's like a $3,000 a month mortgage, a $30 a month tax payment, $400 in maintenance fees or whatever. But oh, in 2024, it's $3,000 in taxes or something like that. And there's a terrible Department of Finance website you can go through to like enter the address exactly as it appears on the tax records and so forth, and then peruse through the property bills. But I just wrote a little thing that injects a script to put in parentheses, actually, it's going to be this after the abatement ends. And we'll see. I'm getting close to signing a contract and I have not published it to the Chrome extension store. So this will probably wither on the vine now. But if you want it, I'm Noah Pryor on Twitter. Send me a tweet and I'll send it over to you.
What sort of toolbox are you using to build this?
So for this one, I started using NX, which is a monorepo management tool. Wildly over-architected, I would say. So I would probably do most of my stuff in Ruby or a backend language, but I want to be close to our front-end team and keep up there. So I try to do all of my side projects, or almost all of them, in TypeScript and JavaScript now. Hasura, I probably wouldn't use it if you're starting a company, but it's a GraphQL API on top of a Postgres database that's pretty good. You can do sort of row and column level permissions, and its query optimizer works pretty well. I mean, the data store isn't really necessary for the showing the taxes. That just hits the New York City API in the Chrome extension in the browser and then puts it in. But the longer term goal there was to have a place to collaborate on your list of listings with your agent or the other people you're working on, since at least like StreetEasy has no share this safe list of listings with people, which is a huge mess. I don't know. So you just email back and forth hundreds of links with your realtor, and it just feels like a super inefficient process.
Do you use Cheerio or Puppeteer at all?
So I started with Cheerio. Basically, I had sort of an in-browser thing that used the like DOM API for it, and then a back-end web scraper with Cheerio to update the listings. I just moved it all over to, I'm blanking on the name, it's whatever JavaScript testing library uses. Basically, there's a much slower DOM querying library for Node that exactly mimics the front-end browser API. That's why I put in the monorepo, is then I can reuse the scraping code in the extension when you're on the page, and then also out of band for updates on the back end, because it's still doing the document.query selector rather than like the almost jQuery Cheerios API.
I had to write a bunch of web scraping stuff in Perl 20 years ago, and it was fairly straightforward. There's a little bit of JavaScript and lazy loading stuff going on, but not much. And now it seems like it's much more difficult with all these obfuscated libraries loading into the browser to navigate everything.
Yeah, no, I mean, these I lucked out because listing page is pretty like SEO optimized. You get like a lot of it on the page or even in like OData tags and stuff. So you don't even have to scrape the HTML directly. You can scrape it like micro schema, but definitely for other things, yeah, running Puppeteer and so forth, it becomes much more of a cat and mouse game, or having to fight CAPTCHAs and whatnot is always a fun system.
Well, speaking of cat and mouse, you told me about a term I had never heard before, a residential proxy network.
Yeah, so that also exists. So there's a company called Bright Data. They used to be called Luminati Networks. I mean, there's a whole industry, but residential proxy networks are, so I mean, your standard web proxy, they'll last use them to try to visit bash.org in middle school or something like that, or high school. You know, it's just a data center somewhere that proxies all your requests. Your IP shows up as them. That doesn't usually work very well for web scraping against places that really don't want you to web scrape, because there's lists of data center IPs and so forth, and they can block all of those and be like, they're probably not a real person. So there are these residential proxy networks where basically these companies pay people to let you pipe their traffic through their residential IP address, or as a way to get freemium options in some service rather than paying the $5. Instead, you let people do this. So it's pretty expensive. It's like $18 a gigabyte or something like that. But theoretically, all of your requests show up as if they're just from some random person's house, and it is much harder to scrape. There are even mobile ones, which are like $30 a gigabyte. I have not tried those, where it goes through mobile apps and it comes in over a cellular network, which is effectively, as far as I can tell, indistinguishable from legitimate traffic.
So I want to write an industrial scale scraper, but if I put that out on AWS and it's coming from AWS IP ranges, everyone's wise to that, so they cut it off. So instead, you're tunneling the traffic through a network of people's home Comcast connections or whatever.
Yeah, and they have millions of them, so you can be like a different one every time. If you do it through your home connection and you're like, I want to load every profile on LinkedIn, LinkedIn will block you, but you can spread it out over many IP addresses.
Huh. Wow. That's a pretty high level of cat and mouse.
I have dealt on the other end with credential stuffing attacks from thousands of IPs. I don't know if they were using that service exactly or something along those lines.
It seems like a semi-legitimized botnet.
Yeah, the differentiator of Brave Data seems to be that the people who are running the proxies know they are running the proxies, as opposed to just having hacked smart light bulbs or what have you, which is the botnet model.
Interesting. So you are a fellow drone owner, are you not?
I am. Yeah, I have an embarrassing number of drones at this point. I've got mostly the DJIs, just picked up the FPV one, which I have been scaring myself with, trying to do tricks.
Are you like flying it in and out of structures and getting a ton of like cool video with it, or what do you do?
I would say that is the goal right now. I would say I'm flying at a not particularly impressive distance from structures and sweating the whole time, occasionally doing flips and looking around being like, did anybody see that? Look what I did.
I've seen a bunch of the videos and I think our multicopter on Reddit or something like that, where people are just doing these insane things. If I had put 1 hour into building a drone and $100, I wouldn't do. And I know they put a lot more than that into it.
Yeah. The first three drones I bought, I would say I wrecked all of them within an hour or so of flying them. So after that, I switched. I bought like all of the insurance. And now I have been heavily insuring the last three drones and have not crashed any. So I'm getting riskier, because I want to justify that $500 in insurance I've paid. But yeah, no, there are some incredible shots out there. There was the one through the like bowling alley that went viral a few weeks ago. It was like one shot that was incredible.
That was pretty awesome. That was a Cinewhoop that the guy had built. And it's this whole class of drones now that are made for making cinema quality fly-throughs. But yeah, they're super small. They fit through spaces that are unbelievable.
Yeah, those were really neat.
So what's your favorite DJI that you own right now?
Probably the Air 2. I don't know. I bought the first Mavic Air, which had the original goggles, which I think you have too. Those sort of big white ones where you look really ridiculous.
Really nerdy.
So I took that to the Amazon with me. I spent 2019, 2 or 3 weeks along the Amazon River in Peru, and got to give that to the locals who live there and let them see what their villages looked like from the air and so forth, which was very neat. But generally, yeah, the second Mavic Airs, I feel like I enjoy watching other people fly the drones at least as much as I enjoy flying them. And it's got the nice, like, it works with the iPad, so you can get like a nice screen. It keeps like 4K high resolution much longer, whereas the original Mavic got pretty blurry after a few feet. It was sort of like dropped to 720p at a certain distance, and it was always kind of jarring.
Do you use the controller where you have to like jam your cell phone into it, or did you get the dedicated one?
There's a dedicated one?
Yeah, it's so much better.
Oh, I will check that out. Okay.
Yeah, it's a little pricey. I want to say it's like $600 or $700, but you don't have to plug your phone into it. It has a full HDMI out.
Oh, okay.
Which I sometimes would plug into the FPV goggles, or you could just plug it into something to record if you wanted to.
Oh, I will check that out. I thought that was only for the Pro. That sounds great.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it works with the other models. Might not work with the FPV, but it should work with the Airs as well as the Pro.
Yeah, the FPV has its own camera or own controller system.
Yeah, I accidentally bought the FPV goggles at first, thinking, oh, this is what I need. I don't understand why DJI would make two different kinds of goggles that are completely incompatible with one another.
Yeah, I guess they had like supply chain problems. Clearly, like something did not work out the way they expected with the Gen 1 goggles, because, yeah, it's this weird compatibility nightmare.
So, Noah, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your stories with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.